Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my guest co-host today, Lieutenant Commander Matthew Hippel, USN, standing in for Eagle One, who is on walkabout for a while, and we haven't heard from any public safety people, so he hasn't been arrested. He's not in jail, so I know he's having a good time on the trail. But we appreciate everybody joining us again today for another live edition of Midrats. And if you're with us live, you can go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room where our good friend Paul Withington is standing athwart bad ideas and saying stop. Go ahead and roll in there. If you have some good ideas you'd like to share during the course of the show, some observations or some questions you would like for us to address to our guests, that's a great place to go in order to do that. And if you have to take off during the course of the show and you would like to catch up on what you may have missed, you can always go back and subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, wherever you aggregate your podcast, and you can listen to the rest of the show at your leisure. And let's go ahead and get on with the show. And heck, depending upon how you measure it, almost to a day, our direct involvement in Afghanistan has reached its 18th year. Those Afghans, Americans, British, and other people who have yet to reach their first birthday when the attacks of September 11th took place that drove us in the direction to the modern phase of direct military action in Afghanistan. Those children of 2001 are right now on their way, if not already, to that Central Asian country to pick up in the conflict other generations have yet to put an end to. In the course of the last 18 years, depending upon who you served with or where you were, people have been focused on nation building, counterterrorism, training, capacity and capability building, infrastructure development, even agricultural assistance. We've had a better part of two decades to find a path or combination of paths to help the Afghan people stand by themselves in the modern age. The programs and names have changed, but in the distance and in the big pixels, the ultimate goal was the same. And our guest today is a returning guest, Lieutenant Jack McCain, USNR, and he has returned to Midrats after recently completing a tour to train the Afghan armed forces to fly and use the ubiquitous Black Hawk helicopter. And today we hope to cover his experience there to talk about not just what he did in training, but also some of the background issues related to the involvement in Afghanistan, the experience of working with Afghans on a daily basis, and other topics. Lieutenant McCain, he is currently serving as a naval aviator and a graduate of the United States Naval Academy and Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He's deployed four times to the Pacific, Persian Gulf, and recently returned from Afghanistan as an Afghan hand. He flew alongside Afghan pilots in the Black Hawk. And prior to that, he was a leadership instructor at the Naval Academy and a search and rescue pilot in Guam. He is presently assigned to the Naval Reserves as a helicopter pilot. And both Jack and Matthew, they are here just as individuals. So general disclaimer, they do not speak or propose to represent any of the organizations they may be associated with. Jack, welcome back home and welcome back to Midrats.
I'm incredibly happy to be a third time. It's always a pleasure and indeed an honor to be on, especially with the, I guess you're no longer your officer, but a good friend and peer from the Navy.
Yeah, I'm not a member of JOPA anymore. I don't have access to any cool memes.
Well, you know, we all have our suspicions about the board process, and sometimes you get a data point that just reinforces those suspicions, but we'll accept the results and the opinion of the board anyway. And before we get on any serious questions, Jack, you know, I have to ask, because it's kind of personal to me, because it's been a decade and a few months since I last had to shave off my last glorious deployment mustache. And I do have to give you a hat tip. You made a good run at your deployment stash. Do you miss it?
I actually miss it quite a bit. I found myself reaching up, you know, either comb, brush my mustache. Pretty happy it's gone. She hated that thing.
Yeah, Jack, you're coming in and out a little bit with your audio. So I don't know if there's a window you can stand closer to help with that.
Is this better?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, that's
much
perfect.
Better.
Okay.
There we go. Well, now to kind of roll into the topic at hand. Last month, amazing how the timing works. The military announced that the AFPAC hands are going to sunset. And it's been almost exactly a decade since they initiated that program. And a lot of people, unfortunately, aren't real familiar with it and the program you're a part of. So just to give everybody a scene setter of what you did, your last bit of active duty, talk a bit about the Afghan Hands program. What was its broad goals and your particular role?
Not to go back too far, but when the war broke out, the level of internal military expertise on Afghanistan was very limited. There had been a period of time of obvious great interest after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, where we tried to foster some expertise, but after the Cold War ended, it became fashionable to not care anymore. We're all looking for that peace dividend. And so after the Afghan war started and the war became less of a let's smash the Taliban to a let's help rebuild Afghanistan, they realized that we were fighting a 18-year war 1 year at a time. And so in order to change that, they wanted to create a cohort of nominal experts on Afghanistan who could deploy there, build relationships, but not only that, be able to be somewhat fluent in one of the local languages, whether Dari, Pashto, or Urdu, and build relationships, really get to know the inside of whatever either Afghan government or military that they were assigned to, and be able to lend expertise when they came back to the United States to help inform the policy and strategy process. So it was an intensive, depending on what job you were going to go do. My training pipeline was almost a year long of culture, history, politics, ground combat training, language, and then finally a civilian helicopter transition to fly the H-60 Alpha model Blackhawk.
So Jack, what was your motivation in getting involved with the AFPAC Hands program? I mean, it's definitely, you think about the Blackhawk, it's definitely a ground pounder mission, and you're a naval aviator, kind of. You've been out to Guam, you've been out to PAC, so this is a little different, which is definitely a cause in and of its own, but what was your motivation?
Well, I love being a naval aviator, but there was kind of this yearning to get involved in the ground wars that had really dominated our military existence, you know, you and I, for so long. So I essentially called up the detailer and said, hey, can you find me a combat tour anywhere? And he kind of took a look at where I'd been and what I'd done and said, you'd be a pretty good fit for this AFPAC Hands program. And I really had no idea what it was at the time until I did a little bit of reading. And it seemed like it was the perfect plan, because, you know, there's something to be said about
wanting to take part in the ground wars, but I think there's also, the further I get away from it, the more I seem to understand this, that I think every young, well, youngish in my case, but every young military person wants to see combat in order to essentially test themselves, to see if it's sort of the ultimate extension of the military profession. And I felt like it was kind of a necessity for me to go and try to contribute in any small way I could.
I think that is an underappreciated and unfortunately under-discussed aspect of why people do what they do in the military. And a lot of times I don't think inside our lifelines we even talk about it all that much. I don't know if it's a combination of something that is just understood or if it's kind of an embarrassing and hokey thing to talk about, but it's an important driver on what a lot of people do and why they do it. And, you know, why somebody like yourself, you know, would travel to the other side of the planet to do something like that. It's kind of eternal. Just kind of like many of us never, most people in the military understood exactly why Prince Harry did what he did when he was a young man as well, getting the check of the block, so to speak. But I wanted to ask you a little bit. You had really some of the training groups that embedded with the CANDACs maybe had this experience, but on the Navy side, very few people, maybe people who worked in the PRTs had this experience, but you got to work day to day with Afghans who were aspiring helicopter pilots. If you could talk for a little bit about the background of some of the individuals that really stood out for you, you know, their background, how they got there.
Absolutely. So I think, as I just discussed a little bit, the initial reason for wanting to go in the first place was to see combat, to try to contribute in whatever way I could. But from almost day one, when I met the Afghan pilots and the Afghan, we call them special mission aviators, the backseaters, crew chiefs, it became about trying to make them as best as we possibly could every day. It became a cause that I, you know, the success of the Afghan Air Force became a cause that not only did I risk my life for, but I truly believed in. And one of the stories about the aviators that will give you probably the best, give you a good broad understanding is there was a specific major, I won't use his name for his own safety, but he was from an area of the country that some may or may not know called the Panjshir Valley. He had been stationed in Kandahar at that time for 7 years flying MI-17s to include the MI-17 Rocket Bird, and had been fighting essentially the hardest fight out there, flying day in and day out, thousands of combat hours with no respite, something that we would never ask American aviators to do. He wasn't deployed. He was just home. And he made the Black Hawk transition and was an excellent just stick and rudder pilot, but really cared about how do we build a squadron? How do we, you know, what does it mean to have a training officer to help manage qualifications? What does it mean to have an operations shop that can balance the needs of the ground forces with airframe availability and just general pilot burnout? So he's kind of my shining example of an amazing aviator, but also an incredible officer in the Afghan military. We had other great success stories, but kind of on the contrary, just to give you kind of a risk assessment, was I had a crew chief who had been, he'd been flying in MI-17s for about 6 or 7 years. He was the equivalent of an E-9 in the Afghan military. Not only could he run a 240, like a 240 machine gun like a thing of beauty. But he had been in five Class A, what we would call Class A or total aircraft loss mishaps. So he had either been shot down or crashed five times and still woke up every day, got in the back of a Black Hawk, and went flying. So he's about as brave an individual I can imagine. But the squadron was composed of people who had either been prior aviators or it was all male, but gentlemen who had been taken off the street and trained in the equivalent of the West Point of Afghanistan. And then they would go to primary flight training, just like an American aviator, where they learned to fly small helicopters and then came through the Black Hawk schoolhouse and finally learned to fly missions with the American military afterwards. So all walks of life, rich, poor, and just like any American aviator, they all loved to be flying, especially being 20-something years old, a brand-new aircraft commander flying around in these – they were a little old, but these aircraft had brand-new engines and were strong, stout, maneuverable, just great aircraft and incredibly good crews.
So you're kind of talking about the shining example, the guys that you worked with. Mm-hmm. But in that integration between aviation and the ground guys, an example out there, the Ghost Troops, they just, I guess, almost 25% of the like the Afghani army apparently didn't exist. Like, I think we found that out last week. What was that? So your guys motivated, ready, professional, technically competent, and where they're not, ready to become so. That ground component, integrating with those folks, what was that like? Because it sounds like from what you're discussing, you know, aviation, ready to rock and roll. And I think we all understand that the ground side maybe has some more challenges. So did you encounter that a lot during this attempt to build this aviation community?
So our interaction with the ground forces, not to say it was limited, because it wasn't, but I was an air advisor, so I didn't do as much of the ground advising. But our primary mission was to support the Afghan ground forces with lift, with moving towards an air assault capability, with close air support. So just as in American aviation, just as in the American military, you have individuals who are very, very good, very, very dedicated, and then you have some that are not. And I think the 25% number comes from the implementation of a brand new pay system, a system that they call APPS. I don't even remember what the acronym stands for. But because of that implementation, you now have a direct fund deposit, and you have essentially everything is done through a biometric ID card. So that was, of course, going to shake out a significant number of – I don't know if ghost soldiers is the right way to put it, but taking accountability with, essentially a paper system, it's pretty difficult. When orders would come from Kabul, they would have to be literally written on paper, and then they would have to come to us via what's called a cipher process, which, again, is just paper essentially. So moving from all paper to an electronic system is a big positive, but they're still worried about 100% enrollment. You know, was everybody able to get in? So some people probably dropped that way. And then, of course, there's an element of, there's corruption in all aspects of the world. So I'm not going to pretend that there isn't some level of corruption, but I don't think that it's quite as alarming as 25% of the military is ghost soldiers. It was more of we've implemented I don't know what the material control system on a ship is called, but here we've just implemented this new system and now we have no maintenance tracking. But imagine that's kind of what you're looking at.
Right. It's just so folks kind of know where that brand, that percentage came from. That's taking the size of the Afghan army that was recorded in 2017, and then the 42,000 people cut off. If anyone's like, where did that number come from? But a follow-on to this, maybe the good story side, right? So this is a reform taking 42,000 names that aren't real and possibly getting funded somewhere else. That's a good news story, right? That's clearing a lot of that corruption.
Oh, yeah.
Your pilots and the officers that you're working with, the enlisted that are in Afghanistan, like this is an 18-year war. What was their end game? Like, what did they see their goal as? Because, I mean, you know, Sal said it himself, that this war can vote and smoke now. So what did they see the end goal as? Because they've been there just as long, if not longer, than we have.
So to give you kind of a basic understanding, and this is coming from me as the advisor, not as some sort of, you know, I don't have a PhD in this subject. I just did the training. But also getting to know the Afghans on a personal level, an Afghan in the military or just in general wants the ability to take care of their family. They want security. And they want justice in terms of the ability to have some sort of functioning justice system. Prior to the U.S. invasion, justice was obviously dispensed in the form of the Taliban. And before that, it was a mullah-based dispensing of justice. So people would have grievances. They would bring it to a mullah. The mullah would arbitrate, and then they would move forward. The concept of justice is incredibly important in Afghan society. So I don't think that your average Afghan wants to be able to vote or be able to pick their representative leadership, but they are seeking security, justice, and the ability to, you know, pay the mortgage, take care of their family, that sort of thing. Go ahead.
Did any of them ever describe to you kind of what that looked like to them? Because we're speaking in theory, right? And you and I are both FSFS guys, so got policy, mm-hmm. policy theory. But you met these guys and talked to them on a personal level. What did they imagine Afghanistan's future to look like? Like, what were they fighting for?
I think I had this conversation many, many times with my pilots. And they are fighting for a stable society that is, a free, stable society is what they wanted. By the time you become a Black Hawk pilot in the Afghan military, you are essentially bought in. You are a high priority target for the Taliban because you have a very important skill set, and the Black Hawk was enabling logistics movement, troop movement, being able to interrupt Taliban operations. So they, from what I gathered, they believed in the Afghan military and they were willing to risk their lives for it. And they wanted the Afghan nation in and of itself to become, have strong borders, have a national identity. There's always tribal dynamics. We had groups from every representative from every tribe in Afghanistan that worked with us or that were either pilots or crew chiefs for us. And I never saw conflicted loyalty. I never saw I have to be loyal to my tribe. I saw we are here to do a job. We are here to take the fight to the Taliban. And we are here to try to make an Afghan to them, the Afghan Air Force. An organization that is sustainable, capable, and professionalized.
When you were working with them, I think you already answered the second part of my question early on when you said the other one thing that is universal and shared is a love of flying and the aircraft that they're in. But when over time, you know, cultural barriers, you learn how to work through them, around them, or inside of them to the point it becomes second nature. But when you first got over there and started to train your pilots, what was the greatest cultural barrier that you had from your background that you had to translate through to them to enable a good working relationship?
Mm-hmm. So the one leg up I had was that I spoke the language well enough to be understood. So that gives any advisor instant credibility because you obviously took the time to learn something. So that was incredibly helpful. But I showed up right as Ramadan was beginning to the schoolhouse. So I'm brand new. I'm still trying to figure my own way around these nearly 40-year-old aircraft. And we're on shorter working hours because of Ramadan, and there are obvious cultural sensitivities that are incredibly important. But it was me approaching with my American Navy mindset of, you know, you're deployed, you're on the ship, you need to work all the time, you have no time off, essentially, to, okay, we're going to work from the morning till about noon, and then after that, everyone's fasting. It's probably not a good idea to have this amount of low blood sugar in an aircraft, so if we got to fly, we'll do it early. If we got to do classes, we'll do it early, and after that, we're going to break for the day until Ramadan's over, so you can take care of the prayer that you need to. And it was eye-opening because it's probably, as an advisor, the most challenging time to come into a unit or to work with the Islamic faith, whether it's in Afghanistan or elsewhere. So I think that stuck out the most was just having to be very self-aware during Ramadan.
Matthew, there?
Sorry, I was missing my mute button here. I got like five tabs of notes open. So, getting to that operational cycle, what describe how the Afghan Air Force is actually employed and their level of capability? You know, helicopters, cool. We think of them in the United States as like this amazing vertical lift capacity, but you know, deploying troops out of a helicopter is super dangerous. And there's a lot of people getting trained up that are probably not used to helicopter deployment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of other missions that can be done. How is the Afghan government using its vertical lift capacity?
So I was, again, I keep telling you, I was lucky for this deployment because I really was. I showed up when the Afghan military, the day prior to my arrival, had flown their first flight without Americans on board. So
that's cool.
We were coming from literally ground zero. When I left, my last, because I was doing the ground advising portion in Helmand, where you're essentially a debt OIC, working for the Afghans, helping launch them on their operational missions every day. We were launching 3 Blackhawks and 2 MD-530s in the scout weapons team capacity, so 1 rocket bird, 1 50 cal bird. They would go to an LZ. They would essentially have the scout weapons team sweep it. They'd call it either hot or cold. If it was hot, they'd sanitize it, and then they would put those 3 Blackhawks into, you know, if it's a tight LZ, they'd put 3 Blackhawks where they'd trade places if they didn't have enough room, or all 3 would land and they'd either push troops out or move supplies. So that is an American quality. That is an air assault, if you ask the Army. So we moved to the ability to move troops and supplies into contested LZs without any Americans in the flight, which I think is in under a year. That's an incredibly impressive track record.
For in the Navy. Oh, sorry, Sal.
No, you got a follow on. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So, Jack, you and I are used to the massive safety requirements as operating inside the United States Navy. And a lot of those are, you know, barracks, garrison mentality. You're in a war zone, and this is a war in people's backyard. What safety challenges, and maybe they weren't challenges, maybe it was just a different perspective, did you encounter the difference between the naval aviation you're used to and a bunch of guys trying to kick the shit out of terrorists in their own backyard?
Well, my I again won't mention this other pilot's name for his safety, but we had finally developed a syllabus where Afghan pilots would come to us after their schoolhouse. We would do mission training with them to get them ready to fly operationally. And it was this young, really, really good pilot, excellent education, one of our up-and-comers. It was our first flight together, his first flight with an American advisor. And it was a dark night. Of course, his first flight is at night with us. And we were really not very far away from Kandahar Airfield, and somebody with a machine gun decided they didn't like the noise we were making and tried to shoot us out of the sky. So if you think about going as an aviator, you go to the schoolhouse. We call it the Fleet Replacement Squadron or the RAG. You don't have anybody trying to shoot you out of the sky while you're training. So it's those unique challenges of, yes, we have to train, but we are also, there's imminent danger all around us. So was it normal? It doesn't seem normal now, but at the time there were risks that we understood. We tried to evaluate and mitigate as best as possible. You know, we took into account where we were flying, if it was a dark night, and we trained. What level of training are we going to do? How many aircraft are we operating tonight? So there's always risk inherent in aviation. I think the risks of having to train somebody in a combat zone are higher. And we definitely had some interesting experiences. But I think some of the other challenges that we faced were our aircraft were not equipped with an integrated GPS. So it was very old school. Map navigation. The instrument, they were not IFR rated aircraft. So if you flew into the weather, it was kind of an emergency situation. IFR is instrument flight rules, so flying without reference to anything outside the aircraft. Our maintenance team was actually excellent. So we had great aircraft availability. We had more aircraft than we could possibly have flown. But just the environment itself, the dust, the mountains, high altitude, unfriendly areas. I mean, flying between Kandahar and Helmand is just about every inch of it is unfriendly. So just learning to understand that there are risks, but still be able to train the pilots as best as possible became our primary goal.
I wanted to save this question for the second half of the show, but I knew I'd have to ask it. Otherwise, the gear dorks would be all over me for not asking it. But it's a topic that I heard people arguing about and getting nowhere back in 07 in CENTCOM. And when you look into the training that you were involved with, and other people have for a while, inevitably the argument comes up of the MI-17 versus the Black Hawk. I want to give you a chance to chisel in granite some religion for folks. Just talk to a bit about why the Black Hawk versus the MI-17.
Absolutely. So there, I have to kind of give a disclaimer that, of course, I am very biased when it comes to this topic. I am a Black Hawk pilot. I trained Afghans to fly the Black Hawk. But I also, my graduate degree in military strategy, I have kind of the ability to try to separate myself cognitively from the, this emotional attachment I have to the aircraft. But whether it's policymaker or even just kind of aviation enthusiasts in general, as Americans, have a tendency to orientalize the MI-17 as this unbeatable communist-designed aircraft that you can fix with a rubber hammer and then it just goes flying. In Germany's case, the MI-17, if you're moving large amounts of equipment from a hard-stand runway airfield to another hard-stand runway airfield, it is an excellent aircraft. But unfortunately, we are not supporting large airfields because we have fixed-wing aircraft for that. We're supporting small FOBs in dangerous areas. So you need maneuverability, you need self-defense capability, and you need survivability. And the ability to land quickly in the dust. So the MI-17 is not a great dust aircraft. It has a very, very large footprint to land some of these small combat outposts. And watching the old MI-17 pilots, once they started getting familiar with the Black Hawk, just really, it was a whole new world to them that in a situation, if they're under fire, they can make a hard break. They can get away from the fire. And if they do get hit, the aircraft's probably going to keep flying because survivability was a prime design concern of the Black Hawk. As a lesson out of Vietnam, UH-1 survivability was real low. So they created the Black Hawk with the intent of making it a combat airframe. So the MI-17 does lift really well, but it wasn't volume of lift that we were lacking. It was, can we get into small LZs? Can we land in the dust? Can we keep these outposts supplied to keep not only our people fed and happy, but to be able to enable them to defend and then go on the offensive? So I don't want to knock on the MI-17 too hard, but the arguments that were made against the Black Hawk are really don't take into account the operational conditions in Afghanistan, because very rarely is anybody going to a 15,000-foot LZ to drop things off. Really, a lot of Afghanistan, a lot of where we were operating and where they were intending to operate are normal below 10,000 feet LZs where the Black Hawk's plenty capable.
So we're getting into the gear nerd conversation here, and you'd mentioned operational conditions and some of the limitations of the Black Hawk version you guys are using with IFR and GPS. Did you encounter a lot of field innovation? And if you did, maybe discuss some of your favorites.
So my absolute favorite field innovation, and the Americans can't take credit for this, but one of our aircraft were moving goats around because – or goats and sheep because there's no refrigeration in most of these combat outposts, so the way you keep food fresh is make sure it's alive. And a goat got hungry and chewed on an emergency jettison handle for a window in the cabin of the Black Hawk and jettisoned the window. So it kind of became our – collective problem to figure out how do we control livestock in a Black Hawk. Something I never ever thought that I would interface with as a naval aviator. And it turns out that in Afghanistan, tomato bags, like the bulk tomato bags, are pretty robust and they come with a drawstring. So you could put the goat or the sheep in the tomato bag and take and put it around their neck so that they can't escape, and it immobilizes them. It keeps fluids or solids inside the tomato bag, and aircraft.
Well, with both of y'all having young sons, the threat, do I need to go get a tomato bag, might come into play.
I've thought about it more than once.
Oh, and Jack, you are fading out just a little bit. I don't know if there's a relocation. We can still hear you fine. You're just fading out a little bit.
Good.
Going again, talking about flying in Afghanistan is a guy who's got a solid background in Arizona and Southwest. One thing about Afghanistan is from the air, it looks a lot like Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, West Texas. It's just in the details that things get a little bit different. For especially for Navy helo pilots, you know, what's the big difference about flying rotary wing in Afghanistan that really can surprise people?
So I am going to make every weapon school person that I know angry right now. And I apologize in advance, guys. I'm sorry. But the Navy, the HSC community, the community I come from, has a really impressive repertoire of capability. Hellfire, 20-millimeter cannon, rockets, CSAR, just regular search and rescue logistics. You name it, we do it. But what they did not prepare me to do, not for lack of trying, was to land safely in the dust. And that became, I knew when I was going to Afghanistan that I was going to have to get good at it, because I'd have, not only was I going to have to do it, but I was going to have to teach it. And nothing that I had been taught by the Navy was an effective tool to keep me safe landing in the type of real fine powder dust that you get around a place like Kandahar. So we collectively, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Afghans, the Swedes, all got together, and we had to essentially agree on one technique that we thought was safest, that we thought was repeatable, and that we thought was going to make the Afghans were going to be able to hold on to, because if anything is going to teach you what's valuable and what's not, the value of a technique or procedure is not readily apparent, abundantly apparent to one of your Afghan aviators, it will not be utilized. So it taught you to take your tactics, techniques, and procedures, throw them out, and figure out what works. So landing in the dust was my biggest heartburn. It was my biggest worry. So I made damn sure that I was going to be ready. And then it almost became a squadron joke, because every flight, regardless of what we were doing, I would take my students out and I would put them in the dust over and over and over again. Because I hoped and still hope that that one extra dust landing that we did together, not only is good for me as an aviator, but it may keep them alive one more day. So I was the squadron dust landing SME by the time I left.
So this brings up a good question. You mentioned in the beginning, by the time you got there, that they had already done their first flight without an American. So obviously there are a few folks that have been in the system and getting shit done and doing dust landings and other types of combat operations. So they had something to teach. What do you think, or what did you encounter that was the greatest value of lesson to you, either as a professional pilot, just as a military man in general, but kind of maybe something that you saw from the techniques and procedure side that they were doing, that you're like, wow, this is really good.
It is an ancient principle, but again, sorry, weapons school, I apologize. Keeping it as simple as possible. There are things we train to. Reaction to contact is really important. Being able to land in the dust safely, but having a convoluted, 45 PowerPoint slide or more brief to get ready for a mission, really, it was not an option for us. So it taught me to question everything, which is both good and bad, as an aviator, to remember the basics keep you alive. That was my big takeaway, is to put at the basics and to keep everything as simple as you possibly can. Adding a layer of complexity does not help you.
I tell you, that applies to so much. The tendency to overcomplicate things, it can be our worst enemy. I think we could do an entire show just giving examples of that. You mentioned a little bit ago Swedes, and I wanted to ask you, because Afghanistan has never been a strictly U.S. and Afghan operation. There are a lot of other nationalities and nations have contributed, some very significantly, and do to this day in the Afghan program. What other nationalities did you work with?
So I worked with Romanian, Australian, Swedish, obviously Afghan. Brits were there, had limited interaction with a couple of Marine commandos, and then the United States Marine Corps, who can often seem like a foreign nation. But I had two excellent Swedish pilots come fly as Black Hawk instructors, and then I had Australian Special Operations crew chief, who was also excellent and one of the most senior Black Hawk pilots in Australia, come teach with us. So we always made the joke that the Swedes, they're the one that decided not to join NATO, but they still had to cough up a couple of pilots. The number of nations that contribute in a huge way to the fight in Afghanistan was really, I didn't expect that. I knew I'd be working with the Army. I knew I'd be working with the Air Force, but seeing so many different nationalities shouldering so much of the burden was eye-opening.
What was your greatest cultural shock between the other nations? And we talked about Afghanistan, but you know, this is a team sport. Did you encounter any sort of super cultural weirdness between your other aviator partners?
I think more tactical than cultural. Aviation, we on purpose we use very specific terminology, and me being a naval aviator, like, nobody else says the word wave off in the military, so I had to divorce myself of that. But a lot of the non-standard terminology that the Swedes used, or that the Australians used, or even the Army used, that we just weren't used to. It took all of us quite some time to kind of get on the exact same page, because not only did we have to get it right between us, but you're working with a third country, you're working with a host nation where their first language is not English. So if we are all saying different things and we can't understand each other, how could we possibly hope to have our Afghan counterparts understand us?
Depending upon where you want to draw the line, the Afghans have an experience of having a big partner leave suddenly on them. When the Soviets left Afghanistan before, the resident government was able to tread water for a while until it fell. And, of course, going back to this administration and the previous administration, it's been clear that we and others are constantly looking at the door to walk out. A decade ago, a common parlance that we would talk about is, you know, we need at least a decade. Well, it's been a decade. We have a fairly low level of personnel there right now, and it looks like that might be a constant level, plus or minus, probably minus a little bit from there. Have mm-hmm. we reached the point where we, as long as we're there to help on the some of the more complicated and financially intensive items, that the Afghans themselves can continue to shoulder this kind of burden? And how much do they look at us looking at the door as they're trying to fight not only the battle today and tomorrow, but next month and next year?
There was always not a readily palpable, but a sometimes, depending on what the headlines said, there was always kind of an undercurrent of worry about, hey, are you leaving? I was never asked the question directly, which I'm thankful for. But I also saw it become a motivator, which is not what I expected, for these pilots in particular to seek out more flying time, to try to perfect their missions. They were having interoperability issues with their scout weapons team, and on their own initiative, they came up with standardized tactics, techniques, and procedures, as well as checklists, so that they could work with their scout weapons team, and it didn't involve our intervention in any way. So there is the Afghan war, big picture, is obviously the political will in the United States is not there for a continued sustained at the same levels as we have been, you know, tens of thousands of troops. But we have had advisory forces in Colombia, in Korea, all over the world that have helped build other militaries. It's a mission we actually do quite often. So Afghanistan has a particular cultural baggage and military baggage associated with it, which is completely understandable. But as professional, capable, and sustainable as I have seen the Afghan Air Force be, that doesn't mean that they don't need our assistance, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be willing to provide it when desired, or you know, sometimes when not desired. Every once in a while, you got to grab a pilot by the neck and say, you need to not do this. Low levels of force are understandable because as they become more capable, you just don't need the same number of advisors. But we should be there not only because it's a moral responsibility, or at least I feel a moral responsibility to the Afghan people, but you've heard it for almost 20 years now, but I promise you they are on their way, especially with the Black Hawk program. They were needing our help less and less every day by the time I left, and they had only been flying it a year.
You mentioned sort of, quote, as their capabilities increase, unquote. What's the evolution of this force? What does it look like? Where does it go from where you and the other trainers that have recently left put it?
Mm-hmm. So I speak from the aviation perspective again, because that's what I know, but if you look at an American Black Hawk squadron, you have a training officer who has a program that says, in order to create a combat aircraft commander, we need to accomplish X, Y, and Z. Then you have an operations officer that says, we have this many aircraft available with this many hours. This is how we are going to utilize those hours. You have a schedules officer that writes schedule for, you know, the next day or the next week, whatever. So just like a normal squadron, when all of those functions can be taken care of autonomously, maybe with course correction here and there, then to me, that's a squadron built. Maintenance is a bit of it's actually a lot easier to create a pilot than it is to create a capable maintainer, as much as that makes all the pilots cringe. Maintenance program building is an intensive process, and I think that's the longest road, not that it's insurmountable by any stretch of the imagination, but the longest and most arduous road is going to be a maintenance program that is self-sufficient. Because you are talking about effective logistics, trains, parts management, just maintainer experience, the ability to look at or listen to an aircraft and say, yeah, this is what I think is wrong with it, to diagnose it. That level of expertise is not there for obvious reasons, because they haven't been working on them very long.
This is a highly subjective question, but I think it's been popping to the top of my head since the beginning of the show. when you mentioned you had to call your detailer and basically ask him, hey, find me a combat related job somewhere that I can do. And from your vantage point, do you feel the big Navy institutionally value service in Afghanistan or combat experience in general? And if it doesn't, you know, where does it place value in the, as we reach the end of the second decade of ongoing combat operations?
I got to be real careful how I answer this one.
I almost didn't ask it for that reason. So if you want, I perfectly understand if you got to tiptoe around it. If you're a smart guy, I figure you find a way.
If you look at the career path of a naval aviator and see that disassociated sea tour in there, it's great to be tactically proficient as an aviator, but you also need to understand how the fleet runs. I completely understand why the Navy values that. I do not think that I think that naval aviation in particular likes what I would call ducks, that a standard naval aviator goes and does junior officer tour and then a production job, flies for the schoolhouse, and then they go to work as either do a disassociated tour and then they become a department head. They have very stratified, very, very particular career track. So getting an aviator off track like I was out in the wilderness flying helicopters to the institution, that's not very valuable. It's cool. It's interesting. But is that going to make me as an officer more valuable? Maybe not. I think, again, my bias is showing, I think there is something to be said about an aviator who has flown in combat, who has seen angry people shooting at you. I think that there is definitely something to be said in that respect, that experience is not something that you can train to. So as an aviator, that might be valuable. But is it a high priority on the table? Is combat experience, if I were sitting on a 04 board right now and they say, well, this guy's got a bunch of combat experience, but this guy did a shooter tour on a carrier, so he kind of gets how that works. I think the board is going to value the shooter tour over the guy flying in combat, which are those proper priorities? That's to CNAF to say and not to me.
Matt, you there?
Hello.
So what's? Yeah, oh. No. Sorry. I'm here. So what's next, Jack? Like, where do you see your USNR now? You've done this kick-ass tour. You've gotten some great flight time. You've gotten that tactical experience. You've had that combat experience you talked about at the beginning of the podcast. So where does a guy like you, who still wants to remain engaged in the profession, where do you see it going?
So I'm real fortunate in that I have a reserve job right now as a flyer that I love. I haven't been doing it very long, but I'm really, really happy to be able to continue to contribute to the, essentially the enterprise that I've dedicated my life to. So I'm beyond overjoyed to be able to do that. Personally, I'm going to have to keep saying at some point I'm not going to be able to use it as an excuse anymore, but I'm still trying to, a lot changed when I was in Afghanistan. So I'm still trying to reengage with my family and make sure my wife knows that I'm home. And in terms of finding a civilian job, you know, this is probably a great place. I'm open for business. So anybody looking for an out of work naval aviator, I'm all yours.
Well, it's a good economy to do that in. And Jack, it's been a great hour. It's been a fast hour. I really appreciate you coming on here. And I wish you the best in transition and look forward to another opportunity to talk to you at some point down the road.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for listening to me ramble for the last hour. And tell you how much it means to be able to sit down with Matt and especially you, Sal. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Hey, it was fun being here. Thanks, Jack.
So, sounds like Matt's in a cab somewhere, this, because he is. and on that note, we're all good on the way. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
All right. Yeah.
Or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.